weather trends, expert takes, and the truth behind the data, you're listening to Weather Waves, found at WXWaves.com.
That distant rumble, you know, the sudden flash, the sky just opening up. We've all experienced a thunderstorm, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely.
These powerful natural events are, I mean, they're a fundamental part of our world, but how many of us really understand the incredible forces at play?
That's the thing, yeah.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the fascinating world of thunderstorms. You've sent us some incredible articles and research, and our mission is really to unpack the science behind these powerful weather events.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go from how they form to the different types you might encounter, and crucially, how to stay safe. Get ready for some serious aha moments, I think.
It's a topic where so much complexity lies hidden behind something we often, you know, take for granted.
Right.
We'll connect the visible stuff, that dramatic lightning, that booming thunder, the heavy rain, to the intricate atmospheric dynamics constantly shaping our weather. It's truly quite a marvel when you look closely.
So let's start with the absolute basics then.
Yeah.
When we talk about a thunderstorm, what's like its core definition?
Simply put, a thunderstorm is essentially just a rain shower where you hear thunder.
Okay.
And since thunder is always caused by lightning, it logically follows that all thunderstorms produce lightning. But yeah, that simple definition really just scratches the surface of what's happening.
Right, right. And to understand why that rain shower, that thunder, that lightning happens, we need to talk about convection.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does that mean, you know, for a storm?
Convection is absolutely fundamental. When meteorologists refer to it, we're talking about that upward movement in the atmosphere.
Okay.
Usually it's created by the sun heating the surface of the earth.
Yeah.
This motion then transports moisture and heat upwards. So a thunderstorm is a direct result of this convection process. It's basically the atmosphere's way of releasing pent-up energy.
It's astounding how common these are, though. Globally, we're talking about an estimated 16 million thunderstorms annually.
Yeah, it's huge.
With roughly 2,000 happening worldwide at any given moment. And here in the U.S. alone, about 100,000 storms roar to life each year. Though, thankfully, only about, what, 10% of those reach severe levels.
That's right. And that prevalence really highlights their role in the global climate system. They're most common in spring and summer, typically during the afternoon and evening hours, when that surface heating is strongest.
Makes sense.
But they can occur year-round. Regionally, you see some differences, too. The Gulf Coast, southeastern, and western states often see them in the afternoon, while the plains states frequently experience them later in the afternoon and often into the night.
And while no place in the United States is entirely immune to severe weather, that greatest threat zone for severe thunderstorms really stretches from Texas up through southern Minnesota, doesn't it?
It does. That's a key area we watch. But yeah, it's always good to be aware wherever you are.
Okay, so we've established the basics of what a thunderstorm is, and wow, it's astonishing prevalence. Now let's pull back the curtain and really explore the incredible journey of how these titans of the atmosphere are actually born and how they evolve. What are those essential ingredients the sources highlight as absolutely crucial?
Okay, for a thunderstorm to form, you really need three things working together. First, plenty of moisture in the air. Simple enough.
Right.
Second, rising unstable air. Now, that's air that, once it gets a little nudge upwards, is warmer and lighter than the air around it, so it just keeps on rising.
Okay, unstable air. Got it.
And that initial nudge brings us to the third ingredient, a lifting mechanism. Think of it like the spark that starts the whole engine.
Like what?
Oh, it could be hills, mountains, forcing air up, or even just where different air masses meet, like a warm front hitting a cold front.
Yeah.
Something has to give it that first push.
That's the perfect recipe then. So walk us through the step-by-step dance that follows once those ingredients are in place. How does it all kick off?
It usually begins with the sun heating the Earth's surface, warming the air right above it.
Mm-hmm.
If this warm, moist air then gets that nudge, let's say from a mountain slope, it starts to rise. And as long as it stays warmer than the air around it, it just keeps going up. It's transferring heat upward through convection.
Okay.
As it rises, the water vapor inside cools down, condenses, and starts to form a cloud. a cumulus cloud.
And that cloud just keeps building higher and higher.
Exactly. The cloud grows upward, pushing into parts of the atmosphere where temperatures are below freezing. This is where ice particles begin to form.
Oh, okay. Ice.
Right. And these little ice particles grow by collecting more water vapor and also these things called supercooled liquid drops.
Super cool.
Yeah, that's water that stays liquid even below freezing. It's just waiting for something like an ice particle to bump into so it can freeze onto it.
Wow.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting for lightning. As all these ice particles and supercooled drops are swirling around and colliding inside the cloud, they don't just bounce off. They actually rip off tiny bits of electric charge from each other. Like static electricity on a huge scale.
Okay.
Seriously, this friction, this sort of microscale dance of ice, is where the storm's incredible electrical power starts building up. It turns that cloud into a giant natural generator.
That's incredible.
It builds up massive regions of positive and negative charges, and eventually the difference gets so large it discharges. Zap! A bolt of lightning.
Which, of course, creates the sound waves we hear as thunder.
Exactly. That sudden heating and expansion of air from the lightning bolt.
That's a powerful image. A giant atmospheric static electricity generator. So, once this process is underway, how does the storm truly evolve? Our sources describe it almost like a three-act play.
That's a perfect analogy, actually. Act one is the developing stage.
Okay.
This is marked by that cumulus cloud being pushed upward by an updraft. That strong rising column of air we talked about. It looks like a towering cumulus, really growing tall.
Is there rain yet?
At this point, there's little to no rain reaching the ground, but you might start to see occasional lightning flashes within the cloud or maybe reaching out.
Gotcha. Then the storm moves into its most dramatic phase, Act Two, the mature stage.
Yes, the mature stage. The updraft is still feeding the storm, keeping it going, but now precipitation rain... maybe hail starts to fall out.
Yeah.
And this falling precipitation drags air down with it, creating a downdraft.
Okay, so updraft and downdraft now.
Exactly. And when this rain-cooled downdraft air hits the ground, it spreads out, forming a gust front, that line of strong, gusty winds you often feel just before the heavy rain hits.
Right, I know that feeling.
This mature stage is when the storm is truly at its most potent. It's the most likely time for severe weather. Hail, heavy rain, frequent lightning, strong winds, and, yeah, potentially tornadoes.
And finally, the storm's grand finale, Act Three, the dissipating stage.
Right. In the dissipating stage, a large amount of precipitation has fallen, and the downdraft starts to dominate, basically choking off the updraft.
It cuts off its fuel supply.
Precisely. The gust front moves far away from the storm, cutting off that warm, moist air supply that was fueling it. Rainfall intensity decreases.
But it's not necessarily safe yet.
No, absolutely not. It's important to remember that lightning can still be a significant danger during this phase, even as the storm looks like it's weakening. Don't let your guard down too soon.
Good advice. So that's the full dramatic arc of a single storm. As these powerful systems play out, they often present some really iconic visual cues. What should listeners maybe be looking for in the sky?
That's a great point. While many developing storms look like those tall heads of cauliflower, you know?
Yeah, puffy.
The really mature, strong ones often develop these very distinctive anvils, that flat, often kind of stretched out cloud formation at the very top.
What causes that shape?
What's happening there is the updraft, that rising air, has hit a layer in the atmosphere, often the tropopause, where the surrounding air is about the same temperature or even warmer, so it can't rise easily anymore.
Yeah, it hits a ceiling.
Exactly. So the cloud growth abruptly stops going up and spreads out horizontally, taking on that classic anvil shape. Seeing a well-defined anvil often indicates a strong, mature storm.
Okay, moving beyond that basic three-act play, It turns out not all thunderstorms are created equal, right? We've got quite a spectrum of storms out there.
Absolutely. On the milder end, you have single-cell storms, sometimes called popcorn convection.
Popcorn, okay.
Yeah, because they kind of pop up often on warm afternoons. They're small, brief, generally weak, typically lasting about an hour or so. They're driven by that simple afternoon heating, produce some brief heavy rain and lightning, your classic summer afternoon thunder shower, basically.
Got it. Then we move up in complexity to multi-cell storms.
Right. Multi-cell storms are much more common, your sort of garden variety storms. Here, new updrafts keep forming along the leading edge of that rain-cooled air, the gust front.
So they regenerate themselves, kind of?
In a way, yes. While individual cells within the system might only last 30 to 60 minutes, the entire system can persist for many hours. These can produce hail, strong winds, maybe brief tornadoes, and definitely potential for flooding if they move slowly.
And our sources also mentioned something called squall lines. How are they different?
Squall lines are basically a group of storms arranged in a line, often quite long.
Like a battle line of storms.
Sort of, yeah. They often bring squalls, sudden bursts of high wind and heavy rain. They tend to pass through an area relatively quickly compared to some other types. And while they can produce strong winds and hail, they're generally less prone to producing strong tornadoes than, say, supercells. But don't underestimate them. A long squall line can impact a huge area.
Now, when we talk about the most dangerous storms, the term supercell always comes up. What makes them so unique and so potent?
Supercells. Yeah, they are definitely in a class of their own. They're highly organized storms, and their defining characteristic is a rotating updraft.
Rotation within the storm's core.
Exactly. Scientists call this rotating updraft a mesocyclone. It's like the storm's spinning heart. This rotation is crucial. It helps the storm sustain itself for hours, much longer than other types, and it's what makes it capable of producing the most severe weather, damaging high winds, very large hail, and strong, long-lived tornadoes.
And what kind of environment do they need?
They often develop in environments with strong vertical wind shear. That means the wind direction or speed changes significantly as you go higher up in the atmosphere. This change helps create that crucial twisting force needed to get the updraft rotating.
Okay, so that rotation is key. Now, we've covered individual storm types, but sometimes these storms aren't alone. They team up, right? They form bigger systems.
Absolutely. And that brings us to mesoscale convective systems, or MCSs for short. Think of these as a whole family or collection of thunderstorms acting together as one large unified system.
How big are we talking?
Oh, yeah, it can be huge, capable of spreading across an entire state and lasting for many hours, sometimes over 12 hours. And within that larger MCS family, we sometimes identify specific, more organized structures. For example, a mesoscale convective complex, or MCC.
Right.
That's a particular type of MCS. It's large, generally circular, very long-lived, and easily spotted by satellite imagery. They often pop up late at night or early in the morning over the central U.S.
And then there's this intriguing thing called a mesoscale convective vortex, or MCV. What's that about?
Yeah, the mesoscale convective vortex, or MCV, is fascinating. It's essentially a low-pressure center, a spinning area of air that's kind of the lingering ghost of a decayed MCS.
So it outlives the storm system itself.
It can. It can persist for up to 12 hours after its parent MCS dissipates. And what's truly remarkable here is that an orphaned MCV, this leftover spin, can sometimes drift along and actually seed new thunderstorm outbreaks later on.
No way.
Yeah, or in some cases, if it moves over warm ocean water, it can even become the nucleus around which a tropical storm or hurricane develops. It's a fantastic example of how weather systems have memory and can influence future events.
That's incredible. A leftover storm seeding a whole new one. Amazing. Finally, in this rogues gallery of storms, we have derechos. These sound like they cause a very specific type of widespread damage.
They absolutely do. Derechos are widespread, long-lived wind storms associated with rapidly moving lines of showers or thunderstorms, often squall lines.
But it's the wind, right?
It's all about the wind.
Yeah.
They cause damage similar in intensity to some tornadoes, but critically, the damage occurs mostly in one direction along a straight swath. That's why it's called straight line wind damage.
How far can they go?
To be classified as a derecho, the wind damage swath must extend for more than 240 miles and include wind gusts of at least 58 miles per hour along most of its length, with potentially much stronger gusts embedded within it. They can flatten huge areas of trees or crops and cause significant structural damage.
That's quite a spectrum of storms. From the little popcorn shower to a derecho, carving a path for hundreds of miles. So for our listeners, what's the ultimate takeaway here? Is it simply about size, or is there a more fundamental characteristic that separates a nuisance shower from a truly dangerous event?
That's the crucial point to grasp. While size can matter, the key insight from the science is organization and rotation.
Okay.
A simple popcorn storm is relatively chaotic and short-lived. But a supercell, with its organized, rotating updraft, that mesocyclone, is an incredibly efficient, self-sustaining engine capable of producing sustained, severe weather. That organized spin is often the game changer that elevates the threat level significantly.
Right. Organization equals potential danger. That makes sense. These various storm types, from the brief popcorn shower to the destructive derecho, all carry significant risks. Which brings us to a really crucial question. What are the real hazards thunderstorms pose, and which one, maybe surprisingly, causes the most devastation year after year?
Yeah, this is a critical point for safety awareness. Many people might immediately guess tornadoes or lightning, and those are absolutely dangerous.
I did get the headline.
They do. But our sources are very clear on this. Rainfall from thunderstorms causes flash flooding, and flash flooding kills more people each year in the U.S. than hurricanes, tornadoes, or lightning combined.
Wow. That's a truly sobering fact, yeah. More than all those others combined.
Combined, it's often underestimated. People drive into flooded roadways or are caught unaware near streams and low-lying areas. It's a silent but incredibly deadly killer.
Okay, that's number one. What are the other major dangers we need to respect?
Well, beyond flooding, lightning itself is obviously incredibly dangerous. It's responsible for many wildfires globally and, tragically, causes fatalities every year. Never underestimated.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's hail. It can range from pea-sized to, in severe storms, the size of grapefruits or even softballs. That can cause massive damage to cars, windows, roofs, crops, and it can injure or even kill livestock caught out in the open. Straight-line winds, like those in a derecho, or even from a strong downdraft called a microburst, can exceed 100, sometimes even 120 mile per hour. They knock down trees, snap power lines, damage buildings, and can be just as destructive as some tornadoes over a wider area.
And then, of course, the one everyone thinks of.
And, of course, tornadoes. Spawned by the most severe storms, particularly supercells, their winds can reach up to 300 mile per hour in the most extreme cases. They're capable of obliterating entire neighborhoods, destroying all but the very strongest structures.
Given all these potential dangers, it's absolutely crucial for our listeners to understand the difference between a severe thunderstorm watch and a severe thunderstorm warning. They sound similar, but they mean very different things, don't they?
Critically different things. This distinction is literally life-saving information. Let's break it down. A severe thunderstorm watch.
Okay, the watch.
This is issued by NOAA's Storm Prediction Center, the national center we mentioned. It means conditions are favorable for severe thunderstorms to develop in and near the watch area. It usually covers large areas, maybe parts of a state or even several states, and is typically valid for several hours.
So what should you do during a watch?
A watch means heads up. Watch the sky, stay informed through weather radio or reliable apps, and be prepared. Severe weather is possible. It's time to review your safety plan. Make sure you know where to go if a warning is issued.
But a severe thunderstorm warning is a whole different level of urgency.
It absolutely is. A warning means severe weather is happening now or is imminent. This is issued by your local NOAA National Weather Service Forecast Office, the regional experts.
And how do they know?
They issue it when severe weather, usually defined as winds of 58 mile per hour or higher, or hail 1 inch in diameter or larger, has been reported by trained storm spotters on the ground or has been indicated by Doppler radar.
So it's confirmed or highly likely.
Exactly. A warning covers a much smaller specific area, like parts of a county or maybe several counties, often moving with the storm. It usually lasts for a shorter period, like 30 to 60 minutes.
And the action for a warning?
The message for a warning is ACT now. Take immediate action. There is an imminent serious threat to life and property in the warn area. Find safe shelter immediately. Go to your designated safe spot, lowest floor, interior room, away from windows. That distinction watch means prepare. Warning means act truly is the difference between preparedness and immediate life-saving action.
That's crystal clear. Prepare during the watch, act during the warning.
Okay, so how do meteorologists actually predict this fury and issue these watches and warnings to keep us safe? It sounds like a combination of incredible detection tools and really sophisticated forecasting techniques. Let's start with the detection side. How do they see these storms?
For detection, especially for tracking storms and seeing the bigger picture, we rely heavily on satellites. Geostationary satellites orbit with the Earth, providing continuous images from space.
What can they see? They show us cloud locations, obviously, but also how quickly clouds are growing vertically. That explosive growth is a key clue for developing thunderstorms. They can also measure cloud top temperatures. Very cold tops mean the cloud has reached a very high altitude, indicating a strong, active updraft, likely a potent thunderstorm. And of course, they track the movement of storm systems.
Okay, satellites give the big picture. And then there's radar, especially Doppler radar. How does that give us a better view inside the storm?
Doppler radar is absolutely vital. Ground-based radar can detect rain and potentially severe weather elements like hail, even when it's dark or hidden within thick clouds. It works by sending out pulses of electromagnetic energy.
Uh-huh.
When these waves hit precipitation particles, raindrops, snowflakes, hailstones, some of that energy reflects back to the radar. The amount of energy reflected back tells us how heavy the precipitation might be.
But Doppler does more, right? The wind part.
Yeah, exactly. That's the Doppler effect part. By measuring the shift in frequency of the returning waves, Doppler radar can tell us how fast the precipitation particles are moving towards or away from the radar. This gives us crucial information about the wind near and inside the storm.
So you can see rotation.
Precisely. This is incredibly helpful in identifying hazardous wind patterns like the rotation associated with tornadoes, the mesocyclone we talked about, strong, damaging straight-line winds like microbursts, and the boundaries like gust fronts. It lets us understand the internal dynamics and structure of the storm in real time.
Amazing tech. Okay, so that's detection. On the forecasting side, the NOAA Storm Prediction Center, the SPC in Norman, Oklahoma, sounds like the command center for severe weather in the U.S.
It is indeed the central hub. The SPC meteorologists monitor atmospheric conditions across the entire continental U.S., 247, identifying areas where severe thunderstorms or tornadoes might develop. They issue those watches we discussed, providing that critical high-level guidance that local NWS offices then use to issue specific warnings.
And what tools do they use for forecasting?
They rely heavily on computer forecast models, also known as numerical weather prediction, or NWP. These are incredibly complex computer programs run on supercomputers.
What do they calculate?
They essentially calculate the behavior of the atmosphere across vast areas from the surface way up high. They take in enormous amounts of data from weather balloons launched globally twice a day, from satellites, aircraft, ships, ground stations, all kinds of observations. And using the fundamental laws of physics and atmospheric dynamics, these models project how conditions like temperature, pressure, wind, and moisture are likely to evolve hours or even days into the future.
And I read about a really fascinating technique they employ now called ensemble forecasting. What makes that so powerful? Sounds complex.
It is, but the concept is pretty clever. Here's where forecasting gets really interesting. Instead of just running one single computer model simulation of the future, supercomputers now run several model simulations at the same time. This is the ensemble. They might run slightly different versions of the model, or more commonly, run the same model multiple times, but slightly tweak the starting conditions for each run, just tiny variations that reflect the uncertainty in our initial observations.
All right, why do that?
Well, if the results from most or all of these different model runs are pretty similar for a certain weather outcome, say, heavy rain in a specific area, then forecasters have higher confidence in that prediction.
Ah, consensus builds confidence.
Exactly. But if the model runs give wildly different results, some show a storm, some don't, some have it move east, some west, it signals that the atmosphere is behaving in a more unpredictable or chaotic way for that time period. It helps forecasters understand the range of possible outcomes and the level of uncertainty, rather than relying on just one potentially flawed deterministic forecast. It's about probabilities.
That makes a lot of sense. And despite all this incredible technology, satellites, Doppler, supercomputers running ensembles, the human element, the meteorologist, is still absolutely essential, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely crucial. Yeah. Indispensable. Meteorologists use their deep experience, their scientific knowledge, their pattern recognition skills, and frankly, their persistence to interpret these complex model outputs.
It's not just reading printouts.
Not at all. Those models now produce these vivid color graphic displays, which is a vast improvement over the old black and white maps, believe me. But you still need a trained human to synthesize all the information, compare different models, understand potential model biases, look at observational trends, and even, yes, look out the window. Their trained eyes and years of understanding how the atmosphere actually behaves are irreplaceable for making the final forecast decisions and communicating the risks effectively.
That's great to hear. The expert touch is still vital. Okay, those answers really clarify a lot about how we predict and track these storms. Let's tackle some frequently asked questions that came in from our listeners. Seems like there's a lot of curiosity out there. First up, why do we even have thunderstorms in the first place? What's their purpose, so to speak?
That's a great fundamental question. And if we connect this to the bigger atmospheric picture, there are really two main reasons. First, thunderstorms are a primary way for the atmosphere to release built-up energy.
Energy release?
Yeah. Remember how warm, moist air rises? When that water vapor condenses into cloud droplets and ice crystals, it releases latent heat, the energy that was used to evaporate the water in the first place. Thunderstorms are very efficient at transporting this heat vertically, helping to balance temperatures between the surface and upper atmosphere.
Okay, so they're like atmospheric heat engines.
In a way, yes. But there's another fascinating role they play. Maintaining Earth's global electrical balance.
Electrical balance. How so?
Well, the Earth's surface generally has a negative electrical charge, and the upper atmosphere has a positive charge. There's a constant fair-weather current flowing, but lightning from thousands of thunderstorms happening around the world effectively acts like a return stroke. It transfers huge amounts of negative charge back down to the Earth.
Wow.
It's estimated that without thunderstorms constantly replenishing that negative charge, the Earth-atmosphere electrical balance would actually disappear in just about 5 minutes.
5 minutes? That's mind-blowing. We don't fully know what would happen then, I guess.
We don't know all the implications, no, but it highlights just how fundamental these storms are to the planet's basic electrical circuit. They're not just weather, they're part of Earth's operating system.
Incredible. Okay, next question. Do all thunderstorms have hail?
That's a common one. Most thunderstorms do produce hail aloft, up where temperatures in the cloud are well below freezing. That's where the strong updrafts can suspend ice particles long enough for them to grow.
But we don't always see it on the ground.
Exactly. Not all hail actually reaches the ground. If the hailstones are small, or if the layer of air below the cloud base is warm and deep enough, the hail often melts completely before it hits the surface. So while hail formation is common within storms, seeing it at ground level usually requires a stronger storm or specific atmospheric conditions.
Interesting. Okay, and a couple of questions about how storms seem to interact with the landscape. We got one asking, do storms really split and go around rivers? And another about why it can rain on one side of the street but not the other.
Right, those are common observations, but they both really come down to a matter of scale. Regarding rivers, there's simply no documented scientific evidence that rivers, even fairly wide ones like a mile across, significantly affect thunderstorm dynamics or cause them to split.
They're just too small compared to the storm.
Exactly. A thunderstorm is a massive system extending tens of thousands of feet vertically and often miles across. A river is, by comparison, a tiny surface feature. Storm movement is dictated by large-scale steering winds high up in the atmosphere, not minor surface features. What people might perceive as splitting is usually just the way multiple storm cells within a larger system are evolving and moving.
And the rain on one side of the street.
That's even simpler. It's just because rain shafts, the columns of falling rain from a cloud, have distinct edges. They have beginnings and ends, both in time and space. Sometimes the edge of where the rain starts or stops just happens to fall right down the middle of your street. You're just experiencing the boundary of that particular rain cell passing overhead.
Makes sense. Just luck of draw where the edge is.
Yeah.
Okay, next up. Why doesn't the West Coast of the U.S., say California, experience nearly as many thunderstorms as the East Coast or the Midwest?
That's largely due to the influence of the Pacific Ocean. The water temperatures off the West Coast are generally much cooler than, say, the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic.
How does that affect storms?
That cool ocean water leads to cooler, more stable air near the surface moving inland. Remember, for thunderstorms, you need that unstable air that wants to rise vigorously. Strong updrafts require temperatures to fall off rapidly as you go up in the atmosphere. The cooler, stable marine air moving inland from the Pacific often inhibits this strong vertical motion, this deep convection needed for thunderstorms to really get going.
So less fuel, less instability.
Duh.
Got it. And along similar lines, are there winter thunderstorms? Can they happen when it's cold?
Yes, they absolutely can happen in winter, but they are much rarer than in warmer months.
Why is that?
It comes back to that same instability issue. Colder surface temperatures in winter generally lead to more stable air overall. It's just harder to get the strong, buoyant updrafts needed to build a tall thundercloud when the surface air isn't particularly warm and moist compared to the air above it. The atmospheric conditions are simply not as conducive for that rapid vertical development most of the time in winter, but it can happen, sometimes leading to thundersnow.
Thundersnow. Okay, that's cool. Finally, a visual one. Why does the sky sometimes turn that really vivid orange or reddish color after a thunderstorm passes, especially in the evening?
Ah, that beautiful post-storm light. Most thunderstorms tend to occur in the late afternoon or early evening, right?
Yeah, seems that way.
So by the time the storm is moving away, the sun is often getting lower in the western sky. The orange or red hue you see is caused by the exact same process that creates vivid sunrises and sunsets.
Which is?
It's called Rayleigh scattering. The setting sun's light has to travel through much more of the atmosphere to reach your eyes. Along the way, the shorter wavelengths of light, the blues and violets, get scattered away by air molecules and tiny particles, sometimes enhanced by leftover moisture or particles from the storm. This leaves the longer wavelengths, the yellows, oranges, and reds, to pass through more directly and dominate the light that reaches your eyes. It's a beautiful atmospheric optics phenomenon.
A perfect, colorful end to the storm.
Uh-huh.
Okay, those answers truly clarify a lot of common curiosities about thunderstorms. Now, crucially, for your action plan, staying prepared. We've talked about the importance of watches and warnings. How can you, listening right now, ensure you actually get these critical alerts reliably?
That's paramount. One excellent option highlighted in our sources is iAlert.com. They're a trusted, established weather alerting company that specializes in delivering official National Weather Service alerts directly to you.
How do they deliver them?
They offer multiple methods via email, text message, and even automated phone calls, ensuring that critical weather information reaches users quickly and reliably, however works best for them.
And what's great, reading through this, is that customization seems key.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just generic alerts, right?
Yeah. Exactly. You can sign up and configure alerts specifically for the locations that matter to you, your home, your workplace, maybe where your kids go to school, or even areas you might be traveling to. You can also customize which types of alerts you receive, like just warnings or watches too, and how you want to receive them. That personalization makes it much more effective.
And it seems widely used.
Oh, yes. The material notes that iAlert.com is relied on by literally thousands of individuals, businesses, emergency managers, school districts, and government agencies. It's a vital tool for protecting lives, safeguarding property, and helping ensure business continuity during potentially dangerous severe weather events. Definitely worth checking out.
Good practical advice there. So there you have it. Wow. We've journeyed through the entire life cycle of a thunderstorm, explored its diverse and sometimes frightening forms, understood its real dangers, and seen how this amazing blend of cutting-edge technology and essential human expertise works together to keep us informed and safe.
Yeah, from that simple rain shower that happens to have thunder all the way up to complex supercells churning out tornadoes and those widespread derechos. These events are just a fundamental, incredibly powerful part of our planet's atmosphere.
They really are.
So, what does this all mean for you listening? Maybe the next time you hear that distant rumble of thunder, you'll consider not just the possibility of rain, but that intricate dance of moisture, heat, rising air, that incredible electrical generation happening miles above your head.
Yeah.
And the sheer power the atmosphere is releasing. And maybe also ponder that other point, how quickly our planet's basic electrical balance could shift without these storms constantly working away. It truly puts their importance into perspective, doesn't it?
It really does. A lot more than just a noisy rain shower. Stay informed, everyone. Stay curious. And maybe check out those alerts. We certainly hope this deep dive helps you understand and maybe even appreciate these incredible forces of nature just a little bit better. Thanks so much for joining us.